From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, fighting and dying in Afghanistan, a clash of political titans in France, and the rising waters of the Bay of Bengal. US Marines and Afghan soldiers have been trying to force the Taliban out of their key strongholds in southern Afghanistan. The fighting has been fierce at times, with the militants using roadside bombs and snipers to slow the advance of the joint force. NPR's Soraya Sahadi-Nelson accompanied a patrol of US Marines and Afghan government soldiers as they tried to move deeper into Taliban territory. Their efforts came at a painful price. A note of caution here. This story includes graphic violence.
The Marines from India Company with the 3rd Battalion, 6th Regiment are itching to move out. They drape extra ammunition belts over their shoulders. They check their weapons. They wait impatiently for the Afghan soldiers who are hours late.
I will move it!
The joint patrol finally heads out at around 2 p.m. Marines with portable minesweepers walk ahead, clearing a path for the armored vehicles rumbling behind. American and Afghan troops fan out over wheat and opium poppy fields. Their objective on this sunny afternoon seems modest, push south about a mile from their base here in northwestern Marja. First Lieutenant Justin Gray heads India Company's 2nd Platoon.
And essentially, we're going to push south and speak with the locals, find out what we can do for them, and basically give them the advice of, hey, you don't want to get caught in the crossfire because there's going to be fighting. The Taliban wants to fight us, and we want them out of Marja. So it's best if the locals just get out of town.
Go. The locals have already obliged. Compound after compound, the Marines and Afghans search are empty.
Yeah. Hurry up! I'm starting to clear. I need a cordon.
In fact, the whole village seems abandoned. There is no sign of the turbaned farmers who toil in the fields, or women in brightly colored tunics who wash clothes and dishes in the fast-flowing canal. Nor are there children playing on the dirt streets. Yet the patrol is not alone. Like villains in a video game, Taliban militants in black tunics pop up on rooftops, from behind mud walls or in trenches. They fire at the patrol with AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades, then disappear.
Hey, suppress! Suppress that building!
Marine Captain Jordan Kondo, who's with the Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company, gets bad news from the aircraft he's talking to on his radio.
North of Building 16, Sector 21, a guy with RPG machine gun moving north.
Lieutenant Gray of the 2nd Platoon suggests a quick fix.
Okay, let's blow them up before they can establish that ambush site. Hey, easy day.
Captain Kondo receives approval for Harrier jets to carry out Hellfire missile attacks. The ambush site is destroyed. Kondo says the militants are badly wounded or dead.
Good for us, because we would have eventually met that ambush site.
Still, the encounters with the Taliban take their toll. Just before sunset, the patrol leaders call it a night. It is too dangerous to push on. The Marines and Afghans have barely covered a half mile in nearly 4 hours. They approach a field near an empty mosque, searching for a place to set up camp. Three militants hiding nearby train their weapons on the approaching group. The Marines and Afghans take cover, crouching behind mounds of dirt. They return fire.
We are to the east. Break.
Among them is Lance Corporal Alejandro Yazzi, a combat engineer from Rock Point, Arizona.
Hey, approximately 300 meters to the east.
Form it up! Form it up!
He's
up.
Dead.
Warming up.
We got a KIA.
What's up?
KIA. Get tick right now.
What's the radio?
I got it.
Give me the radio.
I already told him.
It's Yazzi who is the KIA, or killed in action. A bullet struck him in the head, killing him almost instantly. The 23-year-old is the first Marine in this battalion to die in the offensive. Yazzi had planned to call his wife on my satellite phone that very night. The Marines go after the Taliban gunmen. Captain Kondo again calls for air support. This time, two Cobra helicopter gunships respond. Cobra helicopters, two of them, hitting the trench where the three gunmen were who killed Corporal Yazzie. But the gunships hit the wrong trench. They leave to refuel as darkness falls. Yazzie's body is gently placed in the back of an armored vehicle. He is driven back to company headquarters to begin the trip home a half a world away.
A political duel between two leading statesmen in France is riveting the French public. One of the politicians is President Nicolas Sarkozy. The other is his longtime rival, former Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin. The two men are fighting it out in a Paris courtroom and in the court of public opinion. Eleanor Beardsley sends this report.
Some say you have to look back to the French Revolution and the rivalry between Danton and Robespierre to find such diametrically opposed political foes as Nicolas Sarkozy and Dominique de Villepin. It is a clash of the titans that has captivated the country, says Nicolas Dominac, editor of the political magazine Marianne.
Ça les passionne parce qu'il y a un côté romanesque.
There is a romanesque quality to this fight. It's like two gamecocks going at each other in the ring until death. But this is also a confrontation between two models of French society. The traditional vision represented by literary Villepin, who is a romantic man of letters, and the modern way, incarnated by the capitalist, image-conscious, and Americanized Sarkozy.
Tall, dashing, and aristocratic, Dominique Marie François René Galouzeau de Villepin writes novels and poetry. Many say Villepin believes he has been anointed by destiny to serve his nation, even though he's never been elected to any position. Villepin attended elite French schools and rose through the ranks of diplomacy. Sarkozy is a nervy, short, anti-intellectual, the son of a Hungarian immigrant who fought his way up the political ladder. Sarkozy and Villepin both served in the cabinet of former President Jacques Chirac, and it was as Chirac's foreign minister that Villepin made his famous speech at the United Nations opposing the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Charles Bremner, correspondent for The Times of London, has been following the Sarko-Villepin rivalry for the last decade.
I think the UN speech in 2003 was Villepin's noble moment when he stood like his heroes de Gaulle and Napoleon and tried to hold back the tide. He sees himself as a resistant, and he apparently talks about himself as a resistant, like against the Nazi occupiers. And of course, the enemy is not the Germans this time, the enemy is Sarkozy.
Villepin and Sarkozy's hatred for one another isn't new. Privately, Villepin is said to refer to Sarkozy as the dwarf, but their conflict came to the surface when Villepin was accused of taking part in a plot to destroy Sarkozy's career by associating him with a scandal involving kickbacks from an arms deal. The trial, dubbed the French Watergate, began last October. In what was seen as a blow to Sarkozy, Villepin was acquitted of all charges.
Mon innocence a été reconnue.
My innocence has finally been recognized. I salute the courage of this court, which has put justice and the rule of law above politics.
Sarkozy, who once vowed to hang those who tried to smear him from a butcher's hook, was said to be enraged by the verdict. The next day, the Paris prosecutor, who is indirectly appointed by the president, announced he would appeal against the verdict. Villepin will be back in court by the end of this year. Les Guignols de l'Info is an extremely popular satirical puppet show. Every night on television, the lifelike marionettes impersonate and skewer the country's political elite.
Monsieur, bonjour. Pas de panique. C'est français. C'est la police française. Nicolas.
This episode portrays Villepin holed up as a clandestine resistance fighter. In bursts Sarkozy and his henchmen dressed like Gestapo agents. As marionette Villepin tries to protest, puppet Sarkozy tells him, save your pretty little speeches for the UN.
Tes beaux discours, tu les gardes pour l'ONU.
Julien Hervé is a writer for the show. He says the rivalry between the two men is electrifying an otherwise dull political scene. There's talk of Villepin running for president in 2012. While most people think he has no chance of beating Sarkozy, Hervé says he could divide the right and cause Sarkozy to lose to the socialist candidate.
Le rapport de force est clairement en faveur de Sarkozy.
Sarkozy clearly has all the power, but that's what makes this so great. Villepin thinks he's going to be called back to save the country, just like de Gaulle did. He thinks he's going to liberate the French from Sarkozy.
Some say with Villepin now tied up in court again, he won't be able to run for president. Others predict that Sarkozy's obsession to destroy him could turn Villepin into a victim and popular hero. Whatever the outcome, it's worth noting that both Danton and Robespierre finished their political careers under the guillotine. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley.
Coming up, the rising waters of the Bay of Bengal.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Now we travel to a remote part of South Asia, where the issue of climate change isn't just an acrimonious debate between opposing groups. The people there are directly threatened by the changes in the natural world around them. NPR's Philip Reeves takes us to India and an island on the edge of the Bay of Bengal.
The mid-morning ferry from the mainland has just pulled in. Hundreds of passengers jostle with each other as they stream down the jetty. They're arriving from India's east coast after a short journey across the soupy, flat waters of a giant estuary. The island's quayside stallholders are waiting eagerly. They're cranking on hand presses, turning sugarcane into juice. A man sits on a mat surrounded by exotic shells, advertising his wares by blowing on a conch. This is a good place to do business. Thousands come here to Sagar Island every day. Sagar is part of the Sundarbans, a low-lying archipelago that straddles India and Bangladesh. It's wrapped in the world's largest block of mangrove forest and fans out into the Bay of Bengal. Amid this spray of islands, mudflats and swampy jungle lives the endangered Royal Bengal tiger, an amazing animal that drinks salt water, swims for miles and occasionally kills an inhabitant. The delta is home too to man-eating crocodiles. It's also home to a lot of people, more than 4 million just on the Indian side. They include Varun Pike. Pike is a tough, wiry-looking farmer in his 50s. He's spent his life on Sagar Island. Today he's standing on a long, wide beach, pointing a finger out to sea.
2 kilometers, 3 kilometers.
A mile or two out, beneath the grey waves, lies most of his land, he says. Pike's surrounded by the rubble of a giant brick wall. Large, broken lumps of brickwork are scattered along the beach in a straight line, as far as the eye can see. This is the remains of a barrier built by the authorities. A cyclone ripped down the wall a few years back. Pike now only has 2 acres close by the beach. His land's recently been flooded several times. He thinks it's only a matter of time before it's completely swallowed up.
This year all my land will be gone because the barrier is gone.
Durga Pal lives here too. She's small and middle-aged and weathered by nearly half a century of island life. She says her family's also lost most of its land.
Our grandparents and our parents, they all used to stay here. And we had a lot of wealth and a lot of land before this. But now we are left with very little land and very little money to survive on.
Pal says many people in her village have left.
Happy.
50. Half the community's left because of the sea coming in. What will you do if the sea does come onto your last remaining piece of land? What will you do, sir?
She's not sure, but she and her neighbours are sure about why the waters are devouring their land.
Ah, Bhagwan.
Bhagwan is zimmedar hai. The God is responsible for it.
Gods and gurus play a big part in the life of this island. Sagar Island stands at the point where the Ganges, Hinduism's holiest river, flows into the sea. Once a year, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims gather here for one of Hinduism's largest religious festivals. Most of the island's small thatched mud homes have their own shrine. There are hundreds of temples. At the best known of these temples, a group of women is worshipping. Baba Jitendra Das is one of its priests. He says Hindus come here from all over the world. The temple is about 300 yards from the beach. Das says when it was first built, it was situated a couple of miles away, on land now underwater.
Before this, there were three temples which were destroyed by the water, and this is the fourth temple which was built.
The islands of the Sundarbans have been shrinking and shifting for centuries, partly because of silt and subsidence. But the rise in water levels began to accelerate a few years ago.
Since the year 2000, the trend is actually steeper, upward steeper.
Pranabis Sanyal is a member of India's Coastal Zone Management Authority. Sagar Island is less than 30 kilometres long. Sanyal says in the last 40 years it's shrunk by 25 square kilometres. He's been studying the Sundarbans for most of his professional life. So has oceanographer Sugata Hazra.
For the last 20, 30 years, we are getting more cyclones and we are losing land to the sea. This is the reality.
Hazra's worried about a recent surge in scepticism about climate change, fueled by widely publicized mistakes made by the UN's climate change panel, including the prediction that the Himalayan glaciers could be gone in 25 years. Hazra concedes climate change scientists do make mistakes and should correct them, but he adds,
if they lose the battle to this lobby who are trying to discredit the science of climate change, who are trying to defame the scientists, the world lose the battle.
Hazra says sea levels in the Sundarbans are rising at a rate well above the global average. He says thousands of families have already been displaced, becoming climate change refugees. Hazra says the causes are many and complex, but he's in no doubt human beings are playing a part.
Look, it is definitely a factor. It is not that it is a possibility. It is one of the most important factors is the man-made climate change.
The islanders themselves are not so certain. A group gathers in a farmyard to tell the story of a tiny island nearby. That island completely disappeared beneath the waves 20 years ago. Radha Rani Jana and her family used to live there and had to move here.
Our house and our farms all got submerged.
The families worried that one day the rising seas will compel them to move again. They too see this as the work of the gods rather than people.
Has anybody here heard of global warming? Man-made global warming? Has anybody in this group heard of that? No.
We ask again using different words. Again, there are blank faces. The islanders of the Sundarbans, the people in the front line of the rising seas, know much about the dangers of tigers and crocodiles, but little of the damage mankind is doing to their world. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.